From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, San Antonio v. Rodriguez and the right to an education. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. There is no right to an education under the U.S. Constitution. That was the 5-4 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973 in the landmark case San Antonio v. Rodriguez. This case was a challenge to the way school districts are funded, using local property taxes, which also created a system of separate and unequal schools that is not directly based on race, but delivered disparities along racial lines. On this Texas Matters, we dig into the history and context of San Antonio v. Rodriguez, and we'll continue the conversation on Monday on TPR's The Source on KSTX. The phone lines will be open, and you're invited into the discussion of school funding in Texas. The nonprofit journalism project Follow Media is doing deep and thoughtful reporting on the issue of school finance and inequality. That's at followmedia.org. I spoke to Follow Media journalist Matt Worthington about San Antonio v. Rodriguez.
The Rodriguez case established that education is not protected by the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. And so naturally, that combined with the fact that it came out of the west side of San Antonio seemed like a perfect story for us to look into.
So San Antonio v. Rodriguez, who was Rodriguez?
Rodriguez was Demetrio Rodriguez. He was a parent of Edgewood ISD students on the west side of San Antonio. He was an employee of Kelly Air Force Base. He was a former veteran. And he and other parents who also had children in the Edgewood ISD, they had begun to develop concerns about the conditions and climate that their students endured inside of the Edgewood schools.
So Edgewood was known to be a property poor school. So the property taxes that were at Edgewood ISD, even though they're at the highest rate in San Antonio, they were not providing the same amount of money per student that, say, like the comparison in the case is against Alamo Heights.
It's really fascinating because, and I don't say that in sort of a curious sense, but in sort of a perplexing sense, how a district in the city of San Antonio was the poorest district in all of Texas and in America's 16 largest cities. And so the parents there had sort of established this concern of to say, hey, we now see what's happening in other districts. We see that other districts in the city, they get more resources. Follow Media had spoke with former students who attended Edgewood at that time, and they talked about attending UIL tournaments and seeing the vastly different resources that were provided to them versus the other school districts. And these concerns amounted to a point where the parents had formed something called the Edgewood District Concerned Parents Association. And around that same time, students in Edgewood and also students at the Lanier High School in San Antonio ISD, for related reasons, had staged walkouts to protest the conditions that they were forced to endure.
Yeah, those were the walkouts of 1968?
Correct.
And when did they file the case for Rodriguez?
The original case filed in federal district court was filed in the summer of 1968.
But it took quite a few years for it finally to reach the Supreme Court. But before it got to the Supreme Court, what did it have to do?
Before it went to the Supreme Court, there was sort of a holdup because they had sued the state based on a federal claim. So the claim was that it had violated their equal protection rights. But it was a state law that they were claiming against. So the state gave them a period of time. By them, I mean the state gave the state legislature a period of time to try and resolve this matter, but it didn't happen. And so the court decided the case and determined that, in fact, at the federal district court level, a three-panel court decided that the state had violated the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause.
So there's a chain of events. The Texas legislature was supposed to do something, and they didn't do it. And that provided more momentum that we need to go to the Supreme Court and we need to say the feds have got to step in. And they were thinking Brown versus Board of Education, that that might have been something that could have given them the legal standing to move forward.
Yeah, it's hard to say in terms of direct sources, but when you consider the general mood of the 60s, you had Brown versus Board of Education, which was this landmark court case that had really given people a lot of hope in the education community who wanted to see better opportunities for all of America's children. And then in the 60s, you have this movement towards civil rights. At the same time, you also have a movement for when you consider Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign, there is a campaign for economic rights. And so in some sense, when you look at this case, it's hard to not see it as almost a pair to the Brown versus Board of Education case that said, hey, we're going to integrate schools and ensure that everybody can go to the same schools, that nobody can be discriminated against on the basis of race. And this case tried to establish that there would not be discrimination on the basis of wealth.
It's interesting, you know, 1968, San Antonio, we had Hemisphere going on. Everyone was celebrating that, at the Olympics in Mexico City. There was a lot of positive energy, thinking, you know, we're celebrating the future. And at Hemisphere, you saw all this new tech that was being on display there, video phones and stuff, I remember because I was a kid. But it's simultaneously, we were still fighting the fight about how the schools were in certain parts of town, were heavily Latino, not funded. There were schools were in terrible shape, and they were not getting the help that they needed to in order to be able to compete. And the argument that a lot of people had at the time was that why even fund these schools equitably? Because those are the people who, they don't need education. They're going to be our labor force, doing menial labor. You know, there was not a whole lot of support, you know, across Texas in Austin with our lawmakers and our governor at the time, Connolly, that was worth investing in.
That's a correct assessment of the mood at that time. 1968 was a really pivotal year when you look at the history of the city. To your point, it was a time of stark contrast where you did have the Hemisphere, this massive fair. You also had a civil rights commission that visited the city in 1968. CBS came to San Antonio in 1968 and produced a documentary about hunger. And they profiled and featured San Antonio on the west side and the crisis that many families faced around food insecurity. And the Civil Rights Commission, who came in December of 1968, they chose San Antonio as a case study for discrimination against Mexican Americans in the United States. Most of it was about conditions that Mexican Americans faced in the city of San Antonio. So you did have this exciting movement around the future and
had monorails going around and sky rides and AT&T showing off their new tech, but still you had grinding poverty and there was no hope for economic mobility for a lot of people.
Correct. And the sentiments that Mexican Americans were not going to contribute to the workforce in ways that were more meaningful beyond menial labor was a real thing. The Civil Rights Commission demonstrated instances of discrimination at Kelly Air Force Base, where employees there were hundreds of complaints filed. There were six studies conducted of the Air Force Base, both through the Department of Defense. There was studies from Xavier University, the Texas Advisory Committee. There was a study that Kelly Air Force Base commissioned by a professor at Trinity named Dan Rodriguez. And so you had all these studies that were demonstrating that Mexican Americans were being told that they were not fit for work beyond menial labor. The mayor of San Antonio in 1970 went on a nationally televised broadcast and stated that they were lazy.
That was Mayor McAllister. So when Mayor McAllister went on NBC News and there was a lot of activity when he said that Mexican Americans in San Antonio enjoyed gardening and other things, but they really weren't competitive. So that set the scene for that things were changing when we saw the backlash against McAllister's statements. And I guess the fact that we had a case, San Antonio v. Rodriguez, the people were saying, we're not going to take this anymore. They were going to use the courts to try to find remedy.
Correct. They had got connected to Arthur Gochman, who was an attorney in town through civil rights activist Willie Velasquez. And when they approached Gochman, they really wanted to understand, look, we don't know exactly what's wrong. We don't understand why Edgewood is subjected to these conditions. But they wanted Gochman to advise them on how to move forward. So they first looked into the administration of Edgewood.
Yeah, they thought that people were stealing money or something, that there must have been some widespread corruption. That is like, where's all the money? Why does this school have so much abundance and are able to have microscopes and all these other great things, and we can't? They didn't understand the system. I mean, few people did.
Correct. I think nowadays we take it for granted that we have so much information at our fingertips where we can look into records from hundreds of years ago. And I think back then it was really hard to get information to really see what was going on. So that was one of the first things that they had asked Arthur Gochman about. After Gochman concluded that there was no funny business at the Edgewood administration level, he said, look, your problem is the state's laws. And that's really what is the issue here. So the families filed a suit in the summer of 1968 that claimed two things. And this is according to a Civil Rights Commission report from 1972, although in most accounts of this, only one of these claims is written about. But they had actually claimed that there was disproportionate discrimination on the basis of wealth and on racial and ethnic groups that were predominantly Mexican-American or minorities and also poor.
So that's important because they tried to break these two things out separately and not show that they were there's a confluence of issues here. And saying, well, we're not discriminating against you on basis on your race. Where you're just, your schools are not good because you live in an area that is poor, in property poor. But they never talk about the fact that these are areas that were redlined and not given ability to become affluent through lending practices at the time, which were actually supported by the federal government. A lot of people were not allowed to live in areas of affluence if you were Mexican-American. You were excluded from moving to those areas.
Correct. That's an important part of San Antonio's history that I think we don't know that much about because San Antonio was such a unique city. You know, the city, going back to its history, to its founding, I mean, you dig through history and you go back to its founding, it has deep roots in the Mexican-American community. And a lot of American cities do not reflect that history. And so when you think about redlining, you typically think about, and it's very appropriate because it was incredibly widespread, the discrimination that that occurred towards African Americans across the United States because of redlining. But in the city of San Antonio, it also impacted in a very major way Mexican Americans as well as African Americans. And so trying to separate those claims is just from a human sense, when you look at the history, is a very difficult thing to do. Although in the courts, the claim was separated and the question was only considered about discrimination on the basis of wealth.
This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm speaking with Folo Media journalist Matt Worthington about the landmark Supreme Court case San Antonio v. Rodriguez, which established there is no constitutional right to an education in America. But the argument that eventually got to the Supreme Court was that it's not in the Constitution, but it's implied in the Constitution that there is some sort of freedom of education, that education is important in order to maintain a democracy and in order to exercise many of the rights that are laid out in the Bill of Rights. Did that seem to resonate with the court at all?
Yes. You know, one of the strangest things about reading the hearings, listening to the arguments, and then reading the opinions is seeing how almost apologetic the court was in its decision. So, as you noted earlier, this was a very close decision. It was one vote away from the court agreeing with the Rodriguez families, but they didn't. And so even though they denied the Edgewood families that right to a protected, a constitutionally protected education, they also criticized the basis of property taxes for funding schools. They referred to it as chaotic and unjust. They said, we don't know how to fix this, but it's very clear to us that this needs to be drastically altered or thrown out entirely. And so there was a sense of almost apologizing, but meanwhile acknowledging that, hey, we sort of had to do this because the consequences of this would be unprecedented. So this was Justice Potter Stewart, and he was one of the majority who wrote an opinion supporting the majority. He said, the method of financing public schools in Texas, as in almost every other state, has resulted in a system of public education that can fairly be described as chaotic and unjust. It does not follow, however, and I cannot find that this system violates the Constitution of the United States.
So San Antonio v. Rodriguez failed. 5-4 decision in the U.S. Supreme Court. Many people were stunned by that decision. They thought it was going to win. Why did they think it was going to win?
It's a good question. There was a lot of support. There were several attorney generals from states around the country that had filed amicus briefs in support of Rodriguez. There were a lot of cases being tried in other states across the country that made similar claims. And so there was a lot of energy. There was a lot of motion and movement around the question of discriminatory school finance systems. Rodriguez was the one that went to the Supreme Court. And when it failed and the Supreme Court said, hey, we are not the place that is going to determine how school funding should work. This is best settled at the state level. That put that energy and that motion and movement on hold and sent it back to state legislatures and state court systems.
But it's interesting that it went to a goal line defense. You know, it was right there. It was ready, almost ready to cross the plane and make the touchdown in order to get this victory. What would have changed in the United States if Rodriguez v. San Antonio had won at the Supreme Court? I mean, how big of a deal would that have been?
It would have been substantial. Outside of Hawaii, every other state in the United States would have had to redesign their property tax-based systems. The concern for the courts was that if we set this precedent that education is protected as a constitutionally protected right under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, and that property tax-based systems violate that, well, property taxes pay for a significant amount of public goods and services outside of education. So does that open the door for public roads to be considered in terms of discrimination? Does that open cases for police departments, fire departments, right? So you have all these public goods that are funded through property taxes that the court was concerned would be open to consideration had they set this precedent. So you had both a concern about this is what Justice Powell called an unprecedented upheaval of school funding systems across the country in 49 states. And then you had this concern about what kind of precedent that would set for future cases about discriminating against public goods on the basis of property taxes.
It seems like if Rodriguez v. San Antonio had won at the Supreme Court, then we would have seen this cascade effect across the United States of trying to come up with new ways to fund education on a more equitable basis in a way that you don't bring the good schools down to the level of the bad schools, that you bring up the bad schools to the level of the good schools. And I wondered if the Supreme Court was feeling the pressure, the political pressure, is like, if you do this, this could impact the power and the authority of the court, which is something that these justices are always obsessed with, because they realize there's not a whole lot in the Constitution that actually describes what the Supreme Court does. They're only as powerful as the climate allows them to be. I mean, I think they were afraid. I think they backed off because they knew this was too much to ask for the public at the time. And we ended up with the decision that I have seen other people have written it, calling it akin to Plessy versus Ferguson, which is the Supreme Court decision that affirmed Jim Crow.
I think that's a part of what contributed to this apologetic tone in some of these opinions. You know, you see the majority acknowledging the value of education. They reinstate a contention that the court held from Brown versus Board of Education that said, look, education is perhaps the most important function of local and state governments. We believe that. We believe that property tax systems have perhaps been overly relied on, and that they do need drastic altering. They do need reform, or they need to be thrown out entirely. But again, the consequence, I think that they felt this great burden of, are we the place to do that? Now, whether or not you agree with that, there was this sentiment for them that they felt almost too powerful in terms of what that decision would have in terms of consequences for states around the country.
The fight for equitable educational resources in Texas, getting school districts on equal footing, came back to the state and came again back to this. So did that fall then to the Edgewood versus Kirby case? Was that where this led?
It actually led to several court cases. So there were additional cases involving Edgewood, as with Edgewood as the namesake, not necessarily Rodriguez. But immediately after the Supreme Court decided, you know, in the months and years after, there was a lot of energy saying, hey, look, you know, Demetrio Rodriguez responded by saying, one, the poor people have lost. That was his immediate reaction. And two, we're going to take our fight to the state. And they did. Since the Rodriguez case, there have been seven court cases that that have taken up the question of, you know, the constitutionality in terms of the Texas Constitution.
Because there is a line in the Texas Constitution that talks about education. It's not in the U.S. Constitution, but there is something about education in the state constitution.
Correct. So the piece that we published on Wednesday, November 8th, talks about how Americans have no right to an education. And that is true. There is no federally protected right. It's up to the states. And in Texas, the Constitution of 1845 included a provision that that established a public school system. And that went back to the 1836 Declaration of Independence, when the founders of Texas, which also included Mexican nationals who had sort of left Santa Ana and Mexico, they had criticized Mexico for their failure to establish a system of public education. So the state has very deep roots in public education. And then in 1854, they established the permanent school fund, which we have today.
Today in Texas, we still have many of these same problems. We talk about the issues that plagued Edgewood ISD in 1968. We could be talking about today. Has little changed?
The people that we interviewed for this series of essays that we're producing at Follow Media all talked about the incredible amount of progress that has happened. You know, one of the individuals that we spoke to said that they moved to Texas to work in school finance because the university that they attended in New York had said that Texas had the most progressive school finance system in the entire country. And that might be shocking to some people, but...
So are they talking about the Robin Hood?
Correct. Robin Hood, which is formerly known as Recapture. The 1993 law that Texas passed, which required wealthy districts to share the revenues with poor districts.
So the system we have now seems to be contradicting the concept that we can't have a statewide property tax. That's in the state constitution. So these are workarounds.
Yes. It's very complex. So let's describe it this way. So in 93, a law is passed after much litigation since the original Rodriguez case that establishes a system that tries to equalize funding in the state by taking money from wealthy districts, the excess wealth that they have, and redistributing it to poor districts. That law is informally known. Most people know it by Robin Hood, but formally it was called recapture. And since that time, there have been court cases that have litigated parts of the Robin Hood law and also other facets of school finance. But one of the claims in the early 2000s was that the law was functionally a statewide property tax. So everyone we spoke with said, we are fans of equity. We are fans of redistributing. We understand that poor districts, that they need this additional revenue.
Those kids. Correct. I mean, they're the future. They're the future workforce.
Exactly. And the state today has a much higher population, not just in terms of total numbers, but in terms of the share of economically disadvantaged students in comparison to the state's overall students than it did in 1995. Since then, there's been about a 12% increase. So you have a much greater population of students who have greater need. This was in our interviews. Everybody agreed that students who come from these backgrounds, that they need much more than a student who grows up in a family that has an abundant amount of resources. So no one was critical of Robin Hood because they understand that the state has a great burden and that it's only increasing. But what they're critical about is the state's transparency and ability to effectively redistribute the money generated from Robin Hood.
San Antonio v. Rodriguez is one of the most cited cases, Supreme Court cases. There's a list of, it's in the top 15. Why is it such a landmark case?
Simply because it established that education is not a fundamental right protected by the United States Constitution. So when you think about American law, that case establishing that major precedent is something that is going to have implications for a number of different education claims.
And so it remains active, it remains part of history, remains part of why we have the system that we have today. And someone says, why is one school funded this way, another school has this thing? The answer is
Rodriguez versus San Antonio ISD.
Matt Worthington is a journalist with Follow Media, a nonprofit journalism project. There is a series of reports and essays about education funding in Texas at followmedia.org. The conversation about school finance in Texas continues on Monday on TPR's The Source on KSTX. Phone lines will be open, and you're invited to ask questions and give comments. I'd really like to hear what folks are thinking about school funding in Texas. After all, you are paying the property tax bills, and these are your children. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org or right on our show page on our website, tpr.org. That's also where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.